Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why one analyst is looking at political candidates through a baseball lens.
And a collection of speculative poetry about a future that looks eerily similar to the present.
But first, Arizona appears set to add a new town. Unofficial results from yesterday's election in Pinal County show Santan Valley residents support incorporation by a roughly 2-to-1 margin. Of the more than 12,000 ballots counted so far, the yes side is winning with about 66% of the vote. The Pinal County Board of Supervisors is scheduled to canvass the results on the 18th. If the results hold, the county says Santan Valley will officially become a town after that. With me now to talk more about this is Tyler Hudgens, chairman of the Santan Valley Incorporation effort. Tyler, welcome back. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So are you surprised by the results? I mean, this is a pretty overwhelming victory.
This matches up anecdotally with the conversations that we had with residents in Santan Valley. We continued to run our race as best as we could and hoping for the best, and we're excited with the results.
To what do you attribute this? I mean, why do you think it is that so many of your fellow residents decided this was the way to go?
We think the residents decided to go this way because they innately feel the complex issues that are plaguing Santan Valley. And they want a better future, and incorporation is the vehicle to be able to do that.
Yeah, so what does this allow Santan Valley to do? Why will this, in your mind, make residents' lives better as opposed to continuing to be unincorporated?
Well, the county manages Santan Valley currently, and they manage an area the size of Connecticut. And this is 100,000 people. We are larger than Queen Creek. This will be the largest incorporation effort in state history, largest of this side of the Mississippi in the country. So this is massive, and this area has been managed by supervisors who don't necessarily live in our community. So we have one supervisor who lives there. This will give us 7 local representatives who live in this community, who are invested in this community, who can start addressing these issues.
What are some of the issues that you think need addressing early on?
Yeah, so last week, Rural Metro proposed that they're ready to propose an agreement or a contract with the new town once it incorporates. And currently, fire subscription services, residents have to pay that out of pocket. And those fees are quite expensive. Not everyone has 100% coverage, so not everyone has a subscription. And so if you have a fire, you will get a fat bill from the fire department for them having to come out. And so a town contract could reduce or eliminate all of those fees and then provide 100% coverage to residents. And we think that's going to be a good thing for the pocketbook, and it's going to be for the safety of the community.
Is that the kind of thing where you would anticipate continuing to work with some of those providers as opposed to, for example, develop or building up a Santan Valley fire department of your own?
Yeah, this will give us options. It'll get us to be able to go to the table and determine what's going to be best for the community and start to work with Rural Metro as the current provider to see what options are available there, and then determine how we do that in the future.
So let's talk about logistics. I mentioned that the Pinal County Board of Supervisors will canvass the results, basically make them official in a couple of weeks. I assume you think the results will hold and that you're not going to see some large number of no votes coming out between now and then.
Yeah, we expect that there's on the low side 500 votes and then on the high side 1,000 votes remaining.
Okay.
So in our view, this is Santan Valley will be the 92nd incorporated community in the state of Arizona.
And so what happens next? Like, when do you actually start having, you know, some of the self-determination?
Yeah, so what's going to happen is Pinal County has a legal obligation to maintain and fund services for Santan Valley through July 1, 2026. Now, they have indicated to us that they are prepared to hand over those services at the appropriate time to make sure that the town is set up for success. And then the county is going to certify this election and then appoint 7 individuals from the community to form that first council, who will be like an interim council, and they will serve until August 2026, at which time there will be an election and an elected council will move in. And the responsibility of that first group is really to start up this government, get it up and running, and put in a position for success.
I mean, that seems like, I would imagine, a fair bit of pressure, right? Like, you're really, like, starting this from the ground floor. Like, I would think there's a lot of pressure kind of not to screw up, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a big deal, and it's going to be important, and I think the county knows that, and they're going to make sure that they have the right people in place to be able to set up the community in this first year.
When you look at Santan Valley in a year, 5 years from now, what do you see?
I imagine a better future. I imagine a community that is getting on track. This should have happened 15 years ago. There have been multiple incorporation attempts that have happened, and they have failed before they've ever gotten to a vote. And when our group of citizens came together, we did this with the goal of giving residents the choice for the first time in Santan Valley's history. And that's what we did, and we're excited that the voters agreed and want to move this forward.
All right, I'll have to leave it there. That is Tyler Hudgens, chairman of the Santan Valley Incorporation effort. Tyler, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Baseball has been kind of obsessed with advanced analytics since the book Moneyball came out in 2003. The movie followed in 2011. The idea was to find value in undervalued players, which allows teams to spend less money to win. Nowadays, one of the most common stats to look at is wins above replacement, or WAR. Basically, it measures a player's value by figuring out how many more wins he's worth than another player. For example, according to FanGraphs, defending American League MVP Aaron Judge leads the majors in WAR at 7. That means Judge is worth 7 more wins to the Yankees than if they had someone else in his spot. My next guest has taken that stat and applied it to political candidates. Laksha Jain, co-founder of the election analysis site Split Ticket, says he was tired of hearing people opine about candidate quality without having any data to back their opinions up. So he applied the Moneyball metric, except he's calculating how many more votes a candidate is worth than another. There are a lot of factors that go into this, including controls like incumbency and whether a district is becoming more red or blue. Jain uses the example of Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. He says even if she wins her race by 30 points, that doesn't necessarily tell you how good of a candidate she is, because you need to know by how much President Trump won in that district. Last year, Greene won her race with a little more than 64% of the vote. President Trump won that district with about 68% of the vote. So he says even though Greene won her race convincingly, her WAR might not be all that high. That's because to him, determining the strongest candidates is all about who gets more votes than the generic baseline candidate would get.
I see a lot of value in that because if I'm understanding you correctly, you're really just asking, is there value in figuring out through polls or through studies in general, like how well candidates do with voters relative to the types of voters in their district, right?
Yeah, it's almost like kind of getting a bit of a baseline, right? Like if you are in Marjorie Taylor Greene district, for example, in Georgia, how would a generic nameless Republican do versus a generic nameless Democrat do?
That's exactly it. And that's actually what we calculate, right? That is exactly what we calculate. We calculate the baseline that a generic Republican would have against a generic Democrat. And then we take the results that actually happened and we say, hey, this result saw the Democrat doing 6% better against this Republican than two generic candidates should have had. Now, why is that? Now, once you have the score, you know, people who know context can then add some color to that. But I'll give you the best example. Let's just take David Schweikert. And David Schweikert consistently does like around even with Trump. You know, he runs like maybe like a point behind Trump and people say, oh, like, you know, he's pretty average. No, David Schweikert is actually pretty weak. As an incumbent, he should be doing better than Trump by a, you know, 3 to 4%, and he doesn't. And so you can look at our metric and you can say, hey, hang on a second. Someone like David Schweikert is not actually a strong candidate. Someone like David Schweikert is quite weak. And if you get a blue enough year where the country is just pissed off with Republicans, that's the kind of candidate who's vulnerable.
It's an interesting example, though, because Schweikert is somebody who has been seen as vulnerable, you know, in his congressional runs for several cycles now. And even in elections where Democrats have done particularly well or maybe even better than expected, Schweikert is a candidate who still wins in that district.
You know, He is a candidate that wins in that district, but again, I think it's a question of what's the expectation, right? If, for example, if a generic incumbent just got airdropped into that seat, he would win that seat by about as much as David Schweikert did. He wins that seat because it consistently has like 50, 51, 52% of people giving the Republican nominee for president the vote. But David Schweikert doesn't control how well Donald Trump does in a seat, right? That's not within David Schweikert's control. What is in his control is how many votes he wins above or below, right? Like how many Harris voters he can convince, how many Trump voters he can convince. And we know enough to say he's not convincing very many Harris voters at all.
So it's interesting, and to take it back to sort of a sports analogy, which makes sense, I think, because you're using a sports statistic here. You know, there's the idea of, as you reference Moneyball, you want to be getting as many runs as you can. Obviously, like the more runs you have, the better chance you have to win. But in reality, you only need one more run than the other team to win. And, you know, it sounds like what you're saying is with someone like David Schweikert, he just needs 50% plus one. Like, even though maybe he should be getting more, or another candidate in his district, a Republican, would be getting more, as long as he gets that 50% plus one, he's fine.
Correct, right? Like Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, does really badly in elections, relative to what you'd expect. But she's never going to be at risk of getting below 50%, right? Or getting below 50 plus one. So she's fine in that sense. Now, the reason that Schweikert is different is because Marjorie Taylor Greene's seat sees Donald Trump win 70% of the vote. David Schweikert sees Donald Trump win 51%, 52%. Now, you've been through this whole ride a few times, right? You remember 2008 when the word Republican was basically a slur in half of America. You remember 2024 when people were so mad at Joe Biden that they were voting, that polls were saying Donald Trump was going to win by nine before Biden dropped out. All of that is to say the country can swing by around 10%. And candidates within that 10% range, candidates who win by like less than 10%, need to always watch their six. They need to always watch their back. In baseball, the way I look at it is you may have a weak division and you can get by with winning like 85, 87 games sometimes when your division's weak. But let's say another GM goes out and he decides to sign a big free agent. Let's say Juan Soto signed with the Padres again instead of with the Mets. Now what happens? Now all of a sudden that team has gotten a lot better, and your approach of constantly and consistently winning 85, 86 games isn't going to get you the division title.
So I guess who then, like, who is the Shohei Ohtani or the Aaron Judge of political candidates? Who are the war leaders in your mind?
Oh man, when you get me started on this, I can go on forever. I'll tell you two people that are just truly incredible on the Democratic side and on the Republican side, right? One each. Republican side, Susan Collins.
In
We
Maine,
have
yeah.
rarely seen a candidate like that. Susan Collins in Maine. Liberals will get mad at her because she's still a Republican and she says a lot, "I'm concerned," while still voting for Republicans. But the fact of the matter is, Susan Collins is much more liberal than the average Republican, and so she wins a lot of liberals and moderates and centrists in Maine. And so we have her doing like 15 points better than expected. That's an astronomical number. And then on the Democratic side, it's Amy Klobuchar. Amy Klobuchar is something straight out of science fiction. You know,
From
she does
Minnesota.
from Minnesota. She does 9% better than expected very regularly. You know, Minnesota is not a super blue state, but she consistently wins by double digits because she's Amy Klobuchar and she just is that strong.
How much of that comes down to those particular politicians and candidates having been around public office and public life for so long, and voters just kind of knowing who they are and being familiar with them and feeling like they can really trust them?
You know, that is a big part of it. Trust is the biggest thing in politics. But I will say that, you know, new candidates also do really, really well a lot of the time. You know, in Arizona, for example, Ruben Gallego did 7 points better than expected against Carrie Lake. Now you might say, well, that's Carrie Lake, but still, that's 7 points better than expected. So overperformance is possible from everyone. They just have to commit to trying to win the middle and trying to win the other side.
All right, so you mentioned Ruben Gallego. We talked about David Schweikert earlier. It sounds like Ruben Gallego would sort of be on the leaderboard for war in Arizona. Is there anybody else that comes to mind or that your numbers show does particularly better than sort of the replacement candidate in this state?
Yeah, Mark Kelly.
Hmm.
Yeah, both of your guys' senators are really, really strong. They're not the typical Democrats, according to voters. In general, Arizona Democrats tend to nominate some pretty strong people. You know, even when they lose, like you guys had Eli Crane run against as your Republican. He represents your second district. Well, Jonathan Nez, the president of the Navajo Nation, he ran against Eli Crane and he did 9 points better than expected. So you guys have people from all over the spectrum, especially really Democrats, that are just crushing it with Trump voters. And their only fault is that they're in a seat that Donald Trump has won by 5 points.
All right. That is Laksha Jain, co-founder of Split Ticket. Laksha, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, lesbian fans are a core demographic in supporting and players playing in the NBA, but they weren't always recognized as such. We'll hear about shifts in the league's connection to its lesbian fans and players.
But first, poet Pedro Iniguez grew up watching fantasy and sci-fi movies with his dad. Afterwards, they would have these long conversations about the feats of engineering in these speculative futures, the architectural expertise involved in building space stations, or what it would take to generate the necessary jet propulsion to explore the outer limits of the galaxy. But as much as Pedro loved those conversations, there was something missing from the stories that he and his dad were taking in, Latinos. And it's that tension between what might be and what is that led Pedro to write his latest poetry collection, Mexicans on the Moon, which won a Bram Stoker Award for poetry. Iniguez is the first Mexican-American to win the award. I spoke with him about his inspirations for the poetry collection.
With a lot of the movies, TV shows, and novels that I grew up reading, you very seldom saw Latinos being represented in any way. Even in passing as side characters, you really wouldn't see them. And actors, maybe, here and there, mm-hmm. Maybe like Edward James Olmos
right.
in Blade Runner, mm-hmm. Maria Conchita Alonso in like Running Man, and Ricardo Montalban in Star Trek Wrath of Khan. Other than that, you really wouldn't see Latinos being represented here. So it was something that really impacted me at a young age. And especially as I got older, I really began to notice like, hey, everything I grew up loving just featured white people.
Would you say that the poems that you've ended up including in this collection are an attempt to wrestle with that in some way?
Absolutely. Yeah. I write in the introduction that, you know, because of that lack of representation, I felt that sometimes you have to write yourselves into the futures you want before you're left out of them by someone else. And it's something that I wholeheartedly believe. So it was my attempt to rectify that and create futures where Latinos did exist in these far-flung futures and in space and the frontiers of, you know, of the cosmos. And it didn't mean that they all had to be perfect futures. You know, I speak about the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Yes. Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Pedro, because that's one of the things that to me really stands out about the collection is that it's not the neat narrative that someone might be expecting where you're writing the Latinx perspective into these futures in a way that is always triumphant. In fact, a lot of the times, to my eye at least, you're rendering futures where many of the cycles of repression and subjugation that have been perpetrated on Latino people are still present even in these futures.
Yeah, of course. You know, as much as it is about Latinos in the future, it's also about humanity. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that a lot of our baggage still follows us no matter where we go.
Well, in that vein, I wonder if you could read one of the poems for us. This is a poem called Stuck in a Loop.
Absolutely, yeah. Stuck in a loop. Joaquin slid down the mineshaft, skidding deep into the maw of that ebon abyss. He hacked into the crook of his arm and wiped the soot from his young face. In the swaying lantern's amber glow, the man fizzled into being, his pressurized suit, white and pristine, akin to Joaquin's taskmaster's skin. The man, stumbling, barely able to stand, reached out a hand. "Help, I'm stuck in a loop," he said, before dissolving for the fifth time that day. The little boy lifted his pickaxe and rattled his chains. "I'm stuck too, my friend. See you again later today."
Thank you for sharing that, Pedro.
Of course.
This idea of loops is recurrent throughout a lot of the poems in the collection. The characters in the scenes find themselves replicating power dynamics that have existed for a long time on Earth, even if they're on the moon. Was this idea of history repeating itself, whatever planet that history is unfolding on, part of what you were after here?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I feel that like human nature is very cyclical, you know. Mm-hmm. So these cycles, I feel like it's almost like they're inevitable, like they're bound to happen, you know, whether it be black holes and, you know, the world starting all over again, or people seeing their traditions in new homes, but the oppression still exists, and subjugation and racism and you know, deportation. So these things continue to exist, and they just repeat themselves. It's almost like we can't get out.
Well, if I may, there is also in at least one of the poems sort of an indication that you're telling a bit of a cautionary tale. And I'm thinking here in terms of cautionary tales about the poem Forever Elusive. I wonder, could you read us just the first two stanzas of that poem?
Absolutely. Forever Elusive. The generation ship heralded salvation for those refugees, war-torn, forlorn, and forgotten. For millennia, they sailed on solar tides upon the endless void, dreaming and waiting.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, that poem, there's, again, you know, this is all playing out in my own mind as a reader, but this haunting idea that these people who are accustomed to these cycles of oppression see the possibility of breaking that cycle on this new interplanetary terrain. And yet, the way that poem ends is, you say, on planetfall's eve, they witnessed clans of gray-skinned natives toiling on golden hills and sipping from silver-streamed canals.
Yeah, and it's the poem also addresses, you know, these refugees on a generation ship looking for a new home, and they encounter indigenous people to that planet. And they, you know, they hearken back to their old history, and they realize that they had been colonized by outsiders as well, too. And so realizing that the same might happen to these people, they decide to not land there and continue their search for a new home because they felt that the cycle might continue.
So I want to go back to the beginning of the book and a foreword that was written in tribute to your writing by Gabino Iglesias, who says, quote, "The book you're holding isn't an easy read."
I think he was referring to the fact that there is a lot of dark topics in this. There is a lot of heartbreak, and there's a lot of war and death, and there's a lot of dark humor that tackles a lot of heavy content. So I believe that's what he's referring to. And I agree, but I did try to tackle a lot of the heavy subject matter using humor. To kind of diffuse that. I wanted these messages to get to people. I wanted to be easily digestible.
Yes. And if I may, in addition to the humor that you stitch in here, there's also little oblique moments of optimism about the idea that the future doesn't have to go the way that previous cycles have.
Yes. That was also done on purpose because I am still optimistic about the future, even though there's a dark blanket of terrible things going on. There are little crumbs and little nuggets of light.
Well, a poem that encapsulates, for me at least, a lot of what you were just describing that I'd love to have you read if you would is Harvesting the Future.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be delighted to. Harvesting the Future. Miraya rides the bus in the dark before the sun shines over those verdant fields. She plucks, ties, and bundles boxes of parsley amidst pools of sweat at her bruised heels. Robots are much faster, Hefe shrugs that golden morning she and the rest are chopped, and she watches them hiss and zip up and down rows of countless swaying crops. Without steady employment, Miraya stays to be revoked. Her fate, her future, awaits in a country that seldom cultivates any semblance of hope. Edaya rides the bus to school, where she studies, writes, and reads, hoping opportunities will sprout from those lovingly planted seeds. Wrench in hand, Medaya returns to rain-soaked fields as the machines rev back to life. Robots may be faster, she thinks, as the storm ceases, but humans take their time.
Well, Pedro Iniguez is the author of the poetry collection Mexicans on the Moon. Pedro, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you and your time.
Well, Carlos Kelly is another writer who spent countless hours of his youth roaming fantastical realms. Kelly is also Mexican-American, and he was drawn to the participatory storytelling of video games, where the main character is almost always a stoic white guy. For Kelly, the accumulation of these experiences got him thinking about what the games he loves taught players like him about how the world views people like him. And he writes about this in his new book, Ready Player Juan. I spoke with him about it recently, and as a case study, we began by talking about one of the most popular video games of all time, Uncharted 4. The game follows the adventures of a white treasure hunter named Nathan Drake, and an early scene in the game finds Drake trapped in a Panamanian prison.
Everyone around you is brown and speaking Spanish, and they're all criminals and wearing, like, you know, tank tops, and, you know, cursing at you. And the first thing that comes up is push square to punch or something like that.
Right. That's
and
the
so
first
that's
option.
Your introduction. The first thing is you punch the brown Latinx guy.
Right.
So what does that lead to? Well, he does it on purpose so that he can then get inside of solitary. And when he gets into solitary, then we realize that he's in cahoots with the corrupt corrections officer who is also Latino.
Right.
And then not long after that, we get introduced to the drug lord Latino. And so all those three representations are revolving around criminality, suspicion, untrustworthiness, like the all of these ideas that aren't even original. They're borrowed from film.
Right. The kind of fundamental implicit proposition of that scene in Uncharted is, oh dear, I, a white person, am having to deal with being in this scary foreign place with all these people who want to hit me. Like, what a plot twist that I would end up in a prison. Like,
yeah,
that is sort of a fundamentally white framework to impose on the idea of a main character.
Yeah, and it's and someone with a past of criminality, right? Because Nathan Drake, he's a thief, right? I mean,
yeah, he is a criminal by any definition.
And in his criminal, like, but he's like, it's I don't know, there's a lot of tension there in that observation, right? Because he's a criminal, yet he's not supposed to be there.
Right.
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 And so our, us as the players are like, well, why are we in a prison? Like, Nathan Drake can't be in prison. Like,
right.
But he doesn't belong there, but the other people do. Like, it normalizes the stereotype.
Yes. And I think this also this is also related to a really significant point that you're making in this book, which is that there's a fundamental difference between that moment and a representation of a scene like this in a film, because in a film it's being presented to you, which obviously has a normalizing effect. But critically, in the video game, you are participating in the telling of this very racialized story.
Yeah, and that's the beauty and sort of danger of video games in the sense that I say this all the time, like, the way we can tell video games are a unique medium is that, like, when you die, you don't say, oh my gosh, my character died. You know, you're like, I died. I keep dying. I can't beat this level. I can't get past this boss. I.
Yeah.
And so there's just this extreme connection to our characters and what's happening on screen, and action adventure games are even more important in that way because you spend so much time with that character.
Yeah.
And so you begin to see the world the way these developers have programmed the game.
Yeah. Well, by way of illustrating this, Carlos, I thought we could talk about a scene from another game that you write about in the book, which is called Shadow of the Tomb Raider. And I've got some clips from that scene here, and I thought we could play them and have you tell us a little bit about what's going on in these clips as viewed through the lens that you're proposing here. So just to set the scene here, this is a cut scene where Lara Croft, who is a white British woman, and her, what do you call him in the book? Her, like, friendly
his
Latino
trusty
sidekick?
Trusty POC sidekick.
Trusty POC sidekick, yeah.
Yeah.
His name is Jonah, I believe.
Jonah, yeah.
They are
trying to bust up this corrupt criminal organization, and they're in Cozumel, Mexico, and it's Dia de los Muertos. They're yes. overlooking this square where there's a Dia de los Muertos festival happening. They see somebody who they want to talk to, and they decide to go down and see if they can track this person down. And this is what happens before they go into the square. Jonah speaks first.
You heard that too, right?
Let's see where he goes.
Wait, hold on. Let's try to blend in.
Tell us about that moment where Jonah says, let's try to blend in.
Blending in is an interesting choice of words. Here's Lara Croft, and he says, let's try to blend in. And so he hands you, the player, Lara Croft, a calavera mask. And so you put on this mask, and all of a sudden that is to insinuate that now you blend it in.
Right, that's all it takes. But
it is funny that we think that that's enough to sort of blend in culturally, right?
Yeah. Well, I have a clip here from one of the next moments where Lara and Jonah do venture into the courtyard.
Where did Dominguez go?
He can't be far. He must be in the courtyard somewhere.
Yeah.
Let's look around.
Someone must know something.
So one of the points that you make in the book about this moment, and I'm curious if you can expand on that a little bit, is she's not there to have a Dia de los Muertos experience. She's just there because she needs to find somebody, and they've just kind of stuck her in this place without making any attempt to honor or talk about the nature of what's happening in the square.
No, and because as I argue in that game, it's not about the people in the game. It's always about Lara Croft and her ideas or her pursuit, right? And so one of the kids she would talk to lights a sparkler. And instead of interacting with the kid and asking him about what the sparkler means or, you know, him and his idea, you know, whatever, his subjectivity.
Yeah.
She goes, I should light one for my mom or something like that. You know,
right.
Like, it's always about her. Dia de los Muertos there is not about the holiday. It's about context to like exotify it a little bit more, right?
Right. It occurs to me as we're talking about this that they're also presenting this incredibly rich cultural tradition as an obstacle to this white woman's attempt to do what she's there to do. Like, it's not a rich tradition. It's like a crowded square she has to navigate where people are saying stuff that confuses her.
Yeah, it's like, you know, like any movie, right? Like, the hero's got to go through some random event. Like, this is happening now? Like, I didn't plan for this. It's very much in the service of who they think is going to play in this game, which is mostly people like them, white guys, right?
Right, right. So this makes me think of another idea that you're writing about in the book, Carlos, which is the idea of video games as a kind of border.
Yes. So when I think about video games as borders, I think of it as a firm representation, a line that says, this is how we developers see the world. This is what you're stepping into. This is what you're crossing into. Our beliefs of how we see the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they meant it or not.
Yeah, well, and think about that tutorial we were talking about earlier. I mean,
right.
You are literally stepping into a world where it's like, okay, you want to move in this world? You have to press this button. You want to,
right.
You know, advance the story? You have to punch the brown guy. Like,
right. And so in a sense, we're crossing into these narratives. We can cross into these games and realize that this is some way that somebody sees the world. And if you're someone like me, a Mexican American, then there's this very heavy frictions and tensions that are starting to arise.
Yeah.
But any player can experience these tensions and frictions. It's only about sort of increasing our perspectives and our knowledge. All video games have that ability for us to cross into new stories, new experiences, and new ways of seeing.
Well, Carlos Kelly is the author of the book Ready Player One. Carlos, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Good morning and welcome back to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. And now we continue our ongoing series about shade called Throwing Shade. One of the main goals of shade is to get us out of the sun and cool us down. And while that can make us feel better on a hot summer day or even a not all that hot spring or fall day, it can also be important for our health. Jennifer Vanoss is an associate professor in the Global Futures Laboratory at ASU. I spoke with her about how much shade can help in terms of helping our bodies.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about what heat exposure means for the body under different doses, you could say. So different doses of intensity and different doses of duration. And under not too high intensity and not too long of a duration, heat is not necessarily bad for the body. But we have to be careful about that, especially for people who are potentially older age or have a pre-existing condition, such as a cardiovascular related condition. But if we think about someone who has been out and exposed to a high intensity of heat and maybe for too long, then yes, getting into cooling, any type of cooling from the condition they're in, is really important. And getting rehydrated is really important. But with all of this work we do, it's amazing how much we end up saying things like, it's very context specific, or it depends a lot. And then also we end up really kind of thinking through that individual's, you know, time activity patterns and what does their day-to-day look like? And even what type of heat is it? And the type of heat we experience here in the valley that's extremely dry and hot and sunny is really different than that heat that you might go experience in a place like Florida or some parts of Texas that's really humid, not so hot, and not as sunny.
I wanted to ask you about that last point you made about the dry heat versus more humidity, because it would seem as though, as you referenced and alluded to, that, you know, in a city like Phoenix, you know, maybe planting more trees or having, you know, buildings create shade, things like that, might be more effective than in a place like Florida or, you know, the southeastern U.S.
Yeah, and I think you're right there. When we consider the absolute intensity of the sunlight here versus those other locations, we do have more intense sunlight, and we are not limited in our evaporation in general. There's caveats to that. But when I say evaporation, I mean, when we sweat and evaporate sweat from our skin, that's helping us cool off a lot. But in a place like Houston or Miami, where you have so much humidity, the ability to try and get rid of that humidity, which is really hard to do at the landscape level, but you can think more around using airflow and fans to support evaporation of sweat from the skin, which is really, really valuable in those humid places. And here it's not quite as valuable because it's already so dry. We don't have as big of an issue with getting sweat to evaporate from our skin. But if you're able to take away the sun in a place like Houston, then you still lower the overall heat load on a person. So that's really important. And it's also, I think, easier to provide shade through things like trees in these more humid, moist locations than in a dry desert like Phoenix. So there's a lot of these things to think through, these trade-offs, and really understanding where you get the most bang for your buck in supporting lower heat load on a human is important.
Is it easier to provide tree shade in a place like Houston because it's easier for more kinds of trees to grow there?
Yeah, I think you can grow bigger trees, bigger leaf trees, you have more water available. And so it's then thinking through what's the climate zone there connected to the precipitation levels, essentially. Whereas here, of course, we have a harder time growing trees, we have less water, and the desert adaptive trees that we can grow have smaller leaves on them. So you still don't get as much of the shading that you would want, but they still make a massive impact on the total human energy load on a person.
So again, broadly speaking, is all shade created equally when it comes to cooling down the human body?
Definitely not. You can have pretty measly weak shade that still we might seek on those hottest of days. And then you can have really nice, solid shade that has low transmissivity, so not much of the sunlight is getting through. And I think a nice way to think about shade is not just how well does it work, but how well does it work at different times of day to shade people when they're using that space. So we want to be shading people where they are. You can't shade everything, obviously, and it's really hard to provide shade here and it can get pretty expensive. But if we understand where people are spending a lot of time, parks and playgrounds and bus stops and certain right-of-way areas that people use a lot, sidewalks and so forth. It's really important to think about those spaces and providing shade in spaces where people are. So we want to shade people.
Just to be clear, though, is it safe to say that even that weak, measly shade is better than no shade?
Oh, 100%.
Okay. I'm wondering if planners and researchers like yourself think about different types of shade. You mentioned, you know, shading people and, you know, making sure that there is shade where people are. Is it maybe more important to have different kinds of shade, maybe the stronger type of shade, in a place where people are going to be later in the day, let's say like 4 or 5 in the afternoon, whereas maybe the weak, measly shade might be better suited if you have to have it somewhere where people are going to be earlier in the day when it's not quite as hot?
Yeah, you can think about it that way, in terms of patterns of where people spend time. It's definitely the way way I think about, let's say, how we design playgrounds. And is it a public playground or is it a school playground? Because that means they're going to be getting used at different times of day and even different times of the year.
Mm-hmm.
We want to design for the time of year and time of day that they'll be used the most and that we can provide the most protection. So for any of them, if we know they'll be used in the middle of the afternoon or after school, then we really want to be thinking about that southwest shading. And it's that kind of thinking. And that's actually why it's valuable to work with your communities, your cities, your parents, your kids, to ask them what they want to see, where they see you could have the biggest change in exposure or bring down the sunlight intensity the most, because of when they use that space the most.
I'm also kind of curious about, when you talk about the kind of shade, are there other factors that go into the cooling and how effective the shade is? I'm just thinking, like, in terms of how much air is able to pass through, like if it's a very low overhang and there's not a lot of air that's able to pass through versus something that might be a little bit taller or something that allows a breeze to come through, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whenever we think about heat exposure, we do want to make sure there's some type of ventilation if we can get it. Sometimes the day is just so calm, we don't have any airflow. But yeah, you do want to allow for wind flow if it's present and not be blocking predominant wind flows on the hottest days. And if you have higher structures, you're definitely going to get more of that wind flow at the ground surface. But you don't want them too high or the shade will be cast in a completely different area than you might want it. You can think about like a palm tree, and that's really high up. The canopy is really high up. It's not really providing that much shade. And when it is providing shade, where it's cast is not directly below it.
Jennifer Vanas is an associate professor in the Global Futures Laboratory at ASU, and you are listening to The Show. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Today, lesbians are an important part of the fan base for the WNBA. Many of the players are out, and fans have a safe place to be out and proud. But that wasn't always the case. Not too long ago, our next guest says, the WNBA was trying to brand itself very differently. Rachel Korbman is a humanities professor at ASU and a historian of feminist and queer social movements. She's also one of the coordinators of the Lesbian Herstory Archives. With them, she helped curate an exhibit recently celebrating the lesbian fans of the New York Liberty, a team she's been a fan of her whole life. She spoke more about it with our co-host, Lauren Gilger.
I was 15 when I went to my first game, and I had recently come out as a lesbian. And the experience of games was interesting because there were like a lot of people that I would visually read as lesbians, both players and also fans. But then when I would go home and like watch commercials for the WNBA, it was not branding in that way.
What was it like?
Yeah, it was branding like, think of like the most gendered possible, like deodorant commercials or like tampons. Like that's like what WNBA commercials used to look like.
I am part of a new revolution. I am glamorous. So what?
I am always looking ahead, never behind.
I am not afraid to lose, but I don't like it.
I am not as sweet as you think I am.
Some of the games were in fact like on Lifetime, which is like very different than like how we imagine the brand now.
Yeah.
And it was especially like as a lesbian teenager, this very weird position to like be imagined as a lesbian outside of family friendliness, but also to be a kid. So yeah, it was a very weird experience.
Okay, so let's talk about how that changed, because it definitely has changed. When did it begin to shift?
There's like a number of different things that all were happening at once. But on one hand, you have lesbian fans that start staging actions at games. So at the New York Liberty Games in particular, there was a group called the Lesbians for Liberty that would come to games. So the Lesbians for Liberty started in 1999. Jess Dobkin, who is a performance artist, she's now in Toronto. She just like on her own created a big banner that said Lesbians for Liberty that she brought to a game in 1999. It was a game that was on the same day as the annual Pride March in New York, so on that Sunday. And it was a game that like every year kind of informally functioned as the Pride game because it like was Pride outside of the arena,
yeah.
But not really like inside the arena. So she brought this big banner that said Lesbians for Liberty, and the security guards hassled her and told her that if she like opened the banner that they would evict her from the game.
Wow.
So she was very frustrated by that experience. And like out of that, the big banner initially said Lesbians for Liberty. So that became the name of the group, Lesbians for Liberty.
Okay. And then they affected you, right? Like you will say, you know, are a very long time Liberty fan, not a Mercury fan. We won't hold that against you.
Yeah.
But this was something you saw happen.
Yeah, I was at games at the time. I missed like the 1999 one, but like right. by like 2002, 2003, I was there. So yeah, I remember them handing out palm cards outside of games. They had a kiss-in, which became like the most infamous action that they did in 2002,
mm-hmm.
where they like purposely staged the kiss-in during a nationally televised game against the Miami Soul.
Right.
I was there for that. And it definitely mattered to me to like see cool, like on the ground activism. It was like very exciting.
And it also seems to have affected the league. Like the league today is probably changed because of that moment, those kinds of activists.
Yeah, I think that that's one thread of it is like the fan activism. Then player activism is also tremendously important.
Right. Tell us about that.
So players have been very central in advocating for social justice issues and also for their own working conditions. And then also it's just like broader shifts in marketing, the fact that you could have a league that does some niche marketing to a queer demographic, and that's not imagined as something that'll drive away other segments of their market.
Right. That's an important distinction, right? Because I'm guessing before this was such an open place, that was a big fear.
Yeah. The way that the league was branding was trying to create a safe way to market women's sports.
Right.
Yeah. And kind of like fighting against the longstanding association of female athletes with lesbianism.
Okay. So you study this kind of stuff. You've kind of combined your fandom for the Liberty and your love of basketball. And you also yeah. study queer social movements, feminism. I want to talk about what that looks like in reality, because you did just help curate this exhibit at a Liberty game that shows all of this history, right? And the progression of it.
Yeah. A group of Liberty fans from the Lesbian History Archives curated an exhibit that was at Concourse 23 of the Barclays Center. It was like a mini exhibit of this history.
What did people think? Was it a kind of community moment?
Yeah, it was really fun to see people interacting with queer history in this space where you don't like imagine to have that kind of history available, like in a stadium. That's not like where you usually go to see public history work. So it was really fun to watch because I spent a lot of time with the photos, and in the line to see the exhibit, I would like recognize people from like spending all this time with the photos.
Yeah.
And so I knew that in like 10 minutes, they were like about to see themselves. They would like take selfies with it. They would jump up and down and like point at themselves. And it was really like a moment where it kind of got at what the mission of the Lesbian History Archives is, which is to collect the everyday histories of lesbians and lesbian communities.
Yeah. So final question for you then, Rachel. The WNBA has become a place where, as you're getting at, lesbians are really celebrated now, often out. What does that mean to the community, I guess, to have a brand, a place that's really only growing right now, celebrate them?
Yeah, I think it's really important, especially in this moment that we're in now. So we started talking to the Liberty about doing the exhibit in February, which was like a month after the inauguration of Trump. And I remember in some of like the early meetings that we were having, we were asking, are you like concerned about this political moment? Are we going to like get to like June and you're going to say, actually, never mind? And they told us that, no, this is actually a moment that we think it's really important to like double down on our commitment to being out and proud and to celebrate the various communities that are part of the fan base of the league. So that was one of the things that made it, I think, a really important and powerful collaboration for us.
Yeah. All right. We'll leave it there. That is Rachel Korbman, a humanities professor at ASU, one of the coordinators with the Lesbian Herstory Archives, joining us. Rachel, thank you. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Basketball is my favorite sport. I like the way they dribble up and down the court, just like I'm the king on the microphone. So it's Dr. J.
And that'll do it for this Wednesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a great rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.